Thanks for joining us. This is the Nook and Cranium Podcast.
This is Vince.
All right.
I'm Zach.
And I'm Eric.
Welcome.
Thanks for joining us here. If you're listening, thanks for downloading. If you're on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you don't know we're on YouTube, we are. Nook and Cranium. All right, today we're going to be touching base on a topic that's very important to everything that we stand for. It's vulnerability and being vulnerable with others. And when it's appropriate, in our opinion, we're going to be different people than everybody else. So it's gonna vary. It's going to change. We'll give you our feed on this. We want your feedback. If you're listening or watching somewhere where there's comments, talk to us in the comments. Let us know how you've been vulnerable. Let us know how vulnerability has affected your life. Also, correct us. If we say something that you feel is out of line, let us know if we're wrong. We're not professionals. We're trying to learn this the same way anybody else is. We're students.
So let's start with Zach. Definition of vulnerability.
Basically, openness to physical or emotional harm. What we're going to be talking about is more being open in a way that does make you susceptible to emotional harm. That's the vulnerability that we're going to discuss today.
The reason why we're going to tackle this topic and discuss vulnerability is because, just touching on what I feel, it's something that in today's society we struggle with. I think it's something that everybody struggles to really open themselves up. A lot of our trust issues start young. A lot of the hurt that we experience, it starts at a younger age and it continues to develop. We continue to build up a wall against the people around us, the people who care about us. There are people who are going to be breaking your trust as you get older. And we put up those defense mechanisms, we put up those walls. And as we get older, it's one of those things where you have to really navigate and learn how you break down those walls. And you also have to be careful because there are people who don't have your best interests in hand. So I think it's one of those things where we'll touch on a lot of that. So,
yeah. And also, you're saying about those mechanisms, as you get older, they become habit. You know, it becomes second nature, you know, almost subconscious for you to have those walls up. You know, even new people you meet, even in a safe place around people that you may vaguely know, you still got those walls up because you grew up putting those walls up. You grew up needing those defenses. And I'll be the first to say I'm no role model for vulnerability. You know, that's something that I've struggled with for a long time. You know, I haven't always been vulnerable with people. And it's probably cost me a lot of, you know, worthwhile relationships along the way. But maybe it saved me from some stuff. And we'd like to touch base on maybe some ways that we've learned or concluded to pick the best times for us when maybe it's appropriate to be vulnerable. Maybe not appropriate to be vulnerable.
Yeah. And it's interesting just while you guys are talking, I'm thinking and you know, and it's a thought that needs more, you know, exploration, you know, from our point of view. But if you are, let's say, guarded, maybe to the point of even being isolated, for an example, in certain areas, what seems up front like a lack of vulnerability, could that create actually a vulnerability just by being isolated or being, you know, closed off to relationships or to, you know, maybe having a voice in an area where, you know, that requires you more openness?
You're thinking more like you're not susceptible to certain things for a long period of time or whatever, that are you thinking maybe you would be more vulnerable if you came into situations, or are you thinking that maybe you're just your solitary self, you've walled up around you just by being solitary and you'd be less vulnerable?
Yeah. Well, so I guess, and this thought is still developing and it's a question, but like one thing I think about is strength, the idea of strength in numbers, or having strength with your trusted people around you versus the amount of strength that you might have alone. And in order to have that strength in numbers, you must have a relationship with other strong people or with other people that have enough strength that when you combine your strength, you're stronger than what you are individually.
Which in itself requires you to be at least a little bit vulnerable.
You have to be vulnerable to a certain extent to have trust, I think, between, you know, the people, whoever's in your group. And you know, when you have that trust and that, you know, appropriate level of a vulnerability, then you have that strength in numbers, which will have you less vulnerable to, you know, maybe some outside forces that don't have your best interests at heart the way the people in your circle do.
Is it a good thing to be less vulnerable? I'm sure a lot of times it is, but maybe not always.
Yeah. Yeah, I think context is important. And, you know, like earlier off camera, we had kind of casual conversation about the idea of a safe space. And what is a safe space? What is a place where you can be vulnerable and it's appropriate versus somewhere that's really not a safe space for you to be vulnerable? And how do you, you know the difference?
I think that's going to be key is figuring out how to know the difference, because it might be different for everybody.
Yeah. And it's important, because if you can't tell the difference, then you know, times where you should be bringing some level of vulnerability to a situation to build trust, to voice something that's important with those that you do trust or that those that you want to build more trust with. Versus, you know, being in a situation, you know, where maybe you don't even realize you're being vulnerable because you're not aware. Because there's that too.
Give me an example of how you would be vulnerable. And
so we're talking about emotional, right?
Harm from that. Yeah.
We're focusing on emotional. Maybe you're in a situation where you should be careful, but you're being vulnerable. Kind of ignorantly to someone or a group of people that don't necessarily have your best interests at heart.
I think shielding yourself from that vulnerability, we're gonna kill the word vulnerability. It's the word of the day is vulnerability.
Yeah.
To put up that wall, you could be cutting out meaningful relationships. And I'm not talking about necessarily a significant other. It could be a significant other. It could be regular friends. Even just people that you network with. That you know, broaden your professional life. Certain people you'd want to be vulnerable with. And there's a really fine line between who you'd be vulnerable with and who you wouldn't be vulnerable with. And you kind of have to make that distinction on your own. A lot of people, I would say, without any real statistics, just based on my experience with myself and with people that I've known, most people have a wall up most of the time. And they're closing themselves off to others, I think, you know, and they are losing out on meaningful relationships.
I agree. I think, and this can go back to a prior conversation when we spoke on nature. And so when you look at humans, the way we normally move, we're kind of tribal in a sense, no matter what nationality or ethnicity you look at, we've always moved together. And so I think one of the biggest things that would work to break that is to cause people to be independent or like be able to be singled out. Those people that are singled out are the ones that are, I would say, you can target or manipulate. And so that's just like the pack. You attack the weakest in the pack, but the pack is strong together. So I think at one point in our society, there was a big buy-in to independence. You're strong because you're independent. And it really caused you to believe that. You know, you separate yourself. I can grow myself up. But how much do you think that's really, really hurt the individual as a whole today?
We're social creatures.
Yeah.
And I really think that we needed that. That social interaction, the circles, we've started to get really far away from. It's just me. I think that the first area where we start to see a break in trust is always going to be a child and a parent. And now this isn't on purpose, but this is just a natural relationship. So as a parent is learning how to teach you and develop you, they're going to do things that you as a child, you're not going to understand, you're not going to always like. So you're learning that trust and relationship with your parent. My particular relationship with my parents, my mom and my dad were separated. So there's already like a break in trust because my parents were not automatically together. And so I'm navigating my relationship with my parents separately.
And they probably weren't being vulnerable with one another and setting an example.
Right. And so you learn, you pick up on these things as a child. And so that's to me where a lot of your development of your trust and your vulnerability comes from. How vulnerable are your parents with you? We hurt our parents' feelings. How often does your parent actually let you know that without providing the consequence? Like, does your parent ever actually tell you when you're younger, it hurt me when you did this, versus just kind of lashing out, or I would be prone to get a whooping if I did something wrong. Yeah. And it's just one of those things where some households, and we talked about this somewhere else, that some households are child is to be seen and not heard. So how often as children were you given a voice? I think generations are starting to get that more.
Yeah.
But I'm 37. We're all the same age. I think we kind of grew up in a time where our parents didn't necessarily know how to navigate allowing their children to be open.
I think it,
yes, good point.
I think it rooted from their parents not being open with them.
I agree.
Unfortunately, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, but you know, we got to be willing to step out and change that. You know, we deal with vulnerability in different ways. It affects us every day of our life, you know, and it affects us in more ways than we realize. You know, vulnerability isn't just talking to somebody at the coffee shop and getting to know somebody that you didn't previously know. Although that is vulnerability, that's not the only thing. You know, even in your secure relationships, you know, you find somebody, you trust that somebody, you still have to be vulnerable with that somebody. You know, there's vulnerability in making plans, just having conversations, talking about, my shoulder hurts, you know, guy at work said something really hurt my feelings. You know, just telling that to your spouse is you being vulnerable. People may not realize it, but initiating sex with your spouse, that's you being vulnerable. Yeah. And that goes way, way back. Even before your spouse, you know, you meet somebody, you're interested, you want to talk to them. You know, I know as a kid, I was scared to death to talk to a girl I was interested in. You know, I didn't know, you know, everything would go through my mind. What is she going to think of me? You know, am I going to say something wrong? And maybe. But I would never find out if I didn't take the time to be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, I would never build those meaningful relationships. The worst they could do is, the worst anybody could do is say no, or, you know, that maybe they say something bad about you. I don't know. I never really had any situations like that, but, you know, they can't eat you.
Yeah. A lot of good points there. One of the things I thought about was how society is a certain way. I hear some fireworks going on.
That's exactly what that was.
That's what that is.
Thought it was a bird on the gutter.
Bird on the gutter. Some ninja assassins on the roof or something. I was like, we too vulnerable right now. But I was thinking, because I've lived a few different places. I know we've all lived a few different places. And I notice when I'm in somewhere rural, people behave differently. They're more vulnerable in a sense of, you know, and they love their guns and you know, they're a little bit more savvy with certain other things. But when you go to the grocery store, like complete stranger will come up to you and you might be on your phone doing something and they don't care. They just start talking to you and telling you about their personal life and you know. And it's a kind of openness that is a lot more, you know, rare to come by in a big city or even, you know, a smaller city, but just that city versus being in a rural area.
Because there's that preconceived notion that there's physical harm there somewhere. Mm. A lot of people,
yeah,
overcrowded, you know, it's a lot of input.
Yeah.
A lot going on.
Yeah. And then, like, am I going to see this person again? I think there's like a relevance factor. Am I going to see this person again? Versus being in a small town, you're like, I'm probably going to see them tomorrow. See them on the way home or something. You know,
every day.
They're going to tell my mama.
Yeah. They know somebody I know. I don't know who it is yet. Versus, you know, in the city, it may feel a little more impersonal. Like you see someone, you're like, I'll probably never see them again. And so maybe you don't give it the same consideration. And then there's also, it's like, I don't know what kind of people these are.
Right.
Exactly.
You know,
and a point you made was, we're here, we're talking about this, we're mm-hmm. stumbling through this topic because we're figuring it out and we're learning as we go.
Mm-hmm.
This is us being vulnerable.
Yeah.
We're being vulnerable with each other. We're being vulnerable with whoever wants to listen that we don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hoping that helps people realize you should be more vulnerable at the right times.
The right time, yeah.
You should be more vulnerable. You should make meaningful relationships. You know, you should be vulnerable in your pre-existing relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of people that I know of that them and their spouse don't talk about things.
Mm.
They hardly know what's going on in each other's lives. I don't know how they function that way. I can only imagine they wouldn't function for long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think being vulnerable with your spouse is a way of reinforcing that relationship. You know, letting them know, I'm being vulnerable with you because I trust you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. and I want you to be vulnerable with me. I want you to trust me. You know, we're in this together.
Yeah.
I think it's a very good point, especially with when you look at just society in general and divorce rates. Marriages are tough, and men and women being vulnerable with one another in a relationship, the beginning, the middle, and the end is something that I feel like we struggle with. I'm just now approaching my eighth year, June 25th. Been married for 8 years, and
all right,
it just happened. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, fireworks was for you.
Yeah. Appreciate that. but like, I still find myself nervous with my wife. Sometimes I find myself saying I can't do this, as if like I just met her. Like, it's so weird because it's like, it's my wife. We've been together. But it's like, sometimes I get in my own way of like, maybe she won't like this, or maybe I shouldn't do this like that. And sometimes it's just like, I have to stop myself. Like, I'm being ridiculous, and I just need to do. I know my wife really well. I feel like we're a great team, but I think one of my things that I get in my own head a lot with my relationships, and just being vulnerable right now, one thing that I know about myself is I struggle with trusting people, and it's particularly men. Because as I grew up, a lot of the men in my life were married, and they all got divorces. And so the women that they were married to played a big part in taking care of me. And so once those separations started happening, I didn't get to see the women that played a major part in my life. This is my stepmom. These are like my step aunts. And so it's like, I was experiencing divorces. My grandparents were the first people to like separate. And I really didn't even start thinking about that until a couple of weeks ago, and like how that's really impacted me. So I do admit that I have a difficulty in trusting men in my life, and just building those relationships. So I recognize that that's something that I need to work on.
I'd like to point out that nobody in this room's parents are still together.
That was a good point you brought up, though, about, you know, like you know, none of our parents are still together, you know, and it seems as if it's just a common thing. What Vince was saying earlier today about this culture of independent, you know, me, I can do it by myself, and the individual being praised more over, you know, higher than the value of working together, teamwork. I would even add to like family, you know, because family, that's a team. I think of the family as the first institution that you were ever involved in, is family. You know, if you had a family growing up, that was your first institution.
I think a lot of the families these days, I think a lot of people would be willing to say that their family is class A dysfunctional. Yeah. You know, and not just divorce. I mean, I'd say a lot of families that aren't divorced are probably worse off than the ones that are.
Yeah, well, you know, then like relationship, I think of a relationship this way. It's not a relationship just because you call it a relationship. It's a relationship because you're actually relating. There's got to be the relation there, you know. Just you calling it something and it being functionally that is two different things. So, you know, and I think that's where vulnerability and trust and relating all come together. And it's not just about connecting with the other person, I think, but it's also about deepening your relationship and knowledge of your own self, you know, and the vulnerability of you being open when you're at peace with, you know, maybe your weakness, or, you know, it might be something you're not good at or you're not certain about. But when you're at peace with that within yourself and you can accept that, kind of put your ego aside or whatever you feel may be, could create some discord within you. You just accept that part. Then, even with that openness, you're not vulnerable because you're taking whatever comes. To get there, sometimes you have to be vulnerable, I think.
Yes.
You know, you have to be vulnerable to learn to be open without being vulnerable. In the definition that vulnerable is an openness to being emotionally injured. You know, if that's the definition.
I would go on a limb to say it would be hard to be successful at much without being vulnerable.
Hmm.
And to touch back on family.
Yeah.
I mean, some people have been vulnerable with their families to detriment. Like,
okay.
They've opened up to their family members only to make things worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to.
Right.
I was always told, you know, you can't pick your family.
Not unless you go to a CRISPR therapy facility or something, right?
You can't pick the ones that were already here.
Can't pick the ones that were already here.
Yeah.
I see. That's the difficult part about it. But I think with what you tapped into earlier was that our parents learned a certain behavior. And I think that applies to as we go further down the lineage. Like at some point, someone had to learn the appropriate way to raise up the next generation, and they didn't have those tools. Mm. And so that's what makes family hard, because somebody has to do the right thing, and that's just being available. Being appropriate, and if you don't learn it, that's the tough part. And even when you do, it's still difficult because of all of these outside influences that many of us have to deal with on a daily basis. So it's become really hard, especially with everybody in their phone and
mm-hmm.
social media and entertainment the way it is. It's tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Because there are key differences between being vulnerable with people that you're with in person
mm-hmm.
and being vulnerable with people that you're not looking at.
Yeah.
You know, you got a certain extra courage when it comes to speaking to people on the internet, especially in mm-hmm. negative ways. And I mean, I see that everywhere I go.
Oh, yeah.
I like to go back real quick to family relationships. How old were you when your parents split?
I wasn't even born yet. Man. They split while I was still
in the womb. Yet. What about you?
Probably about 9. Yeah.
I was older. I was, I want to say, 20, I think. I've had people say, oh, well, shouldn't have done much bad to you. You had your parents till you were 20. The problem is my example of a family, my example of a relationship growing up still ended in failure while I was developing. And all of the information that I had up to that point was based on people that didn't make it. People that it didn't happen with. They, you know, so I would say it's different than someone whose parents were separated their entire lives, or someone who, you know, was a young child when your parents split. It's all different.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't think in any case it's good for the child. But let's be honest, if a marriage ends in divorce, it was better for the parents. If a relationship ends in divorce, it didn't need to hold on.
Yeah, it's true. Sometimes it lasts longer than it should.
That's true.
Yeah.
And sometimes it lasts longer for the kids.
Right.
Or some preconceived notion that staying together in a bad relationship is mm-hmm. going to set a better example than separating and them trying to learn two different relationships. It's, you know, who's to say what's better at all? I mean, I know you could argue that they tried,
mm-hmm.
and sure, maybe they did. It doesn't change much in the way of how you develop, how you learn to be vulnerable when you're watching your parents wall themselves up.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult for people to have a successful relationship without the right environment, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's you know, the environment is different things. You know, like I think about the analogy of like a garden or food, you know, like plants. For certain plants to grow, they have to be in the right environment. For them to proliferate, produce more plants. Some of them will grow, but they won't fruit, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, because the environment isn't quite right. So they might grow, be independent individuals, mm-hmm. strong, independent, but they don't fruit. Mm-hmm. They have to be in the right environment. And sometimes there can be a, like a microclimate, right? So the microclimate, the idea of a microclimate, an example of that can be something like a greenhouse, right? So you may be in Iowa in the wintertime where it's, you know, gets down to negative 20 degrees or something like that. But you have a greenhouse, and in the greenhouse, the climate is different. And so now, even though the larger environment is a certain way, you have a microclimate or a smaller environment within it that is suitable for where plants can survive. Certain plants can survive. You know, could be a tomato plant. It can survive in the cold, you know, bitter winter of Iowa if it has the right climate. Mm-hmm. And not only can the plant survive, if the environment, if the microenvironment is set up just right, it can even fruit. It could even produce tomatoes. And so I think, you know, people are the same way. And a lot of times we put a lot of pressure on ourselves as individuals to be strong and to, you know, to get everything done the right way that we can do as individuals. And we fail to look at the climate. We may take ourselves, we may hold ourselves accountable, we may hold our partner accountable, but often we're not looking at the climate around us and asking the question, is this the right environment that we can grow? Is this the right environment that we can, you know, bear fruit, be prolific, proliferate with who we are, whether, you know, you could take that to mean like have a family, raise a family. You know, is the environment right? And the quality of the individual person definitely makes a difference, or the individual people. But also the environment makes a difference too. And if the environment around you isn't particularly hospitable to your growth and proliferation, then how can you build or find a microclimate or an environment, you know, within that environment that is going to allow you to flourish?
Yeah. Think of an apartment in New York City. You know, you're an introvert. You have your peace in your apartment. You go outside, people everywhere.
Yeah.
Might not be your thing.
Yeah.
But it can be argued that if you stay inside, you know, you're not giving yourself the opportunity to be vulnerable with the right people and produce that relationship that, you know, that leads to more quality of life. Maybe it's just relationship with someone that you can talk to on a level that helps you get something off your chest.
Mm. You can have your environment, whether you call that your safe space for being vulnerable, or your greenhouse where you feel like you can flourish, where you got the right things in place. And at some point, you've got to go out of there into the jungle, into the wild. You know, you got to put it together, because, you know, life doesn't come pre-assembled. You're going to have challenges. Everything's not always going to be fair. Everything's not going to be, you know, set up where you look at it and on the face of it, you're like, wow, everything's lined up for me. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that can happen, but the instructions are in Greek. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you got to find your own way. You can piece together your own manual. And sometimes you can have certain things handed down for you, down to you, that are very valuable. And sometimes those things can help you. And sometimes those things can hurt you, because it might not be the right bit of information for you, whether that's information that was given to you verbally or something that you witnessed. and learn through experience. So, yeah.
Well, Vince, I've heard you only discuss how we need to be vulnerable and how vulnerability is important in our lives. How would you think someone shouldn't be vulnerable? What situation would come up that would merit them not being vulnerable?
In some situations where it could be harmful to a person to be vulnerable, you'll see it a lot in abusive relationships. People who we can deem as predators, these are people that look to take advantage of a boy, a girl, their spouse, the person in a relationship. A predator can be a man, woman, a person who is looking to be hurtful, to be manipulative. A lot of times you'll find that there's still a desire for the victim to gravitate towards the predator. So this is a situation where it is kind of dangerous and harmful to be vulnerable, in the sense that it is hard to convince that particular person to get out of that kind of relationship. And so this is where I like to look at how vulnerability is really, in one sense, bad, and then in another sense, if it's developed, it can be good, because the sense of vulnerability that we're supposed to be developing starts in the household with your parents. And so if we experience that division, then we typically do not see what it looks like, the leadership in the household. We miss the relationships of two people having to learn how to work together, how to trust one another, how to have conflict, healthy conflict with one another. And a lot of times when you miss that, you end up not knowing what a good relationship looks like. So a lot of times you may end up in a bad relationship and not even realize what you're getting yourself into. And I'm gonna be honest, I think a lot of young teenagers experience this, because this is when we start dating. You're in middle school, high school years. We end up in relationships and we go full on in. Everybody's happy. We think we're in love. We think we're going to last forever. But then you start running into those problems that you never learned how to navigate. And you're not really communicating your relationship with your parents.
I remember in high school, certain people, it almost seemed like they sought out bad relationships. Mm. Every relationship they were in was bad. Mm. They were go from one toxic person to the next, and it's. I remember reading somewhere that people who grew up in families that were toxic relationships, they see that as a relationship. They see that as what a relationship should be. That's what that's what they actually seek out in a partner, is somebody who reminds them of the relationship that they had at home, or their parents' relationship. And that's terrible. Mm-hmm. I was never in any relationships like that, but I did know people who were constantly in bad relationships in high school. Surprised I remember high school.
That's in and out for me, high school.
It's a long time ago now.
Yeah.
And so if we could even dive into that further, the country that we currently live in, I think, is big for building consumers.
Mm. We're in the States, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. So consumerism is really big here. And so I've always kind of tied it into like the attack on families, the attack on relationships. If you really like navigate social media, you navigate TV, there's conflict everywhere. Most every TV show, no matter what it's about, you're going to witness cheating, divorce, fighting of, amongst men and women. And I feel like there's been a big attack on family. And to me, that is because when you're involved in a healthy family, there's a structure there. And so typically the structure would be a man and a woman and the children. That's a typical household structure. And everybody kind of thinks and operates the same, which doesn't necessarily work for a consumerist society, because in a consumerist society, you then have to go out and want to buy and want to be a part of the trends and the styles. But in a family household, you kind of learn all that stuff in that household. And so the head of the household, and as it trickles down, is kind of teaching you your values. And so just as an example, even though my father wasn't there, a lot of the stuff that I ate, a lot of the stuff that I wore, a lot of the stuff that I was used to, it all stemmed from my household. I can name how I ate and how I processed things because it was built in the household. I feel like when you lose that structure, you're susceptible to be influenced. And in a consumerist society, you need the people to be influenced to be consumers, to go buy the tickets to the sports events, to want to go to the concerts. I want to dress up like Beyonce. I want to be at the latest shows. I want to go see Jay-Z. I want to go see The Baby or whoever else. I think our society wants that. It's more conducive to businesses. It's more conducive to the music industry, food industries. And I think we can all attribute to growing up back then. It was not common for us to really go to fast food restaurants. We were more than likely going to eat home at home, and going to a fast food restaurant was like an experience, especially if you did not have money like that.
Yeah. Oh, Happy Meal.
Families now, and it doesn't matter if they don't have the money or not, they're eating out. Like, they're not cooking at home. Like, even if they can't afford it, their kids have an expectation to go buy fast food. And this stuff isn't healthy now. So this is the stuff that the children that are supposed to be developed, this is what they're eating.
No, but it's subsidized. So it's cheaper than buying and cooking your own food.
Right. And so it's one of those things where I just feel like our society does not care that the family structure isn't there, doesn't really care about the divorce rates
in
America. They don't care about relationships between any couple, because at the end of the day, they're still making the money.
I had a few thoughts while you was talking, you know, related to that. Mainly like an idea of you know, the importance of saying no to maintain your integrity. And if you're saying no to the demands of a consumerist society because you feel like that is what lines up with you acting in your best favor and in line with your integrity, is that, would you call that a form of being vulnerable? Because I think it takes a lot of, it takes a lot of bravery sometimes to say no to something when the social pressures to say yes to it. And sometimes you may feel vulnerable in a way, but also strong because you've kept your integrity. I mean, what do you think about that?
But do you need to be brave to be vulnerable?
Do you need to be brave? I think so. Well, no. Because I think you can... I think to decide to be vulnerable takes bravery, but I think you can also be vulnerable without knowing it due to lack of situational awareness.
I agree with that.
Sure. On the bad side. Mm. On the good side of being vulnerable, I would say it takes courage to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I I think it took courage for us to get together like this and talk about the topics that we get together to talk about.
Traveling uncharted territory.
I know bravery and courage aren't the same thing, but I don't quite know why.
Bravery, the action of braving or acting the bravo, daring, defiance, boasting, swaggering, bravado.
So bravery is a display of courage. What's the definition of courage?
Courage. Mental or moral strength to venture, persevere, and withstand danger, fear, or difficulty.
Mental strength to persevere.
Yeah, mental strength.
And so fear can be a factor, but it isn't the only factor.
It's not the defining factor. Yeah. So maybe we can conclude courage would be like doing something with your heart or doing something with all of your heart.
Then it says courage, showing bravery under fire.
So bravery would be the quality of having courage. So courage is a thing. Bravery is the quality of having that thing.
You can be brave and it still not really define who you are. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the being courageous comes in, because it can define your character, even though you're still being brave. I think a person showing courage is typically putting themselves in a position to be there for somebody else. And that's when we identify it as, oh, they showed courage because they either stood up for somebody, they saved someone's life or their own, or they laid their life on the line. And so a lot of times we'll use that word for like soldiers or a parent who was defending their child. So that's the way I look at it.
And I think, you know, you can be brave and do something that has a risk, but the odds may be in your favor, but it has a risk. So you're like, ooh, I could lose, but I'm going to be brave and take that risk. But then when it seems like the odds are against you and you still persevere, I think that takes courage. Yeah. You know, you may get knocked down. You may fail, not overall, because if you could get back up and try again, but you may get knocked down, you know. Or you may, like I said, you may fail, but it may be a failure where you could fail at something where you can try again. Mm-hmm. You could get gassed up and get a little bravery, right? Like people could slam you on the back, you get a hit of ammonia or something. Woohoo! Like you're all full of caffeine, but then when things really hit the fan, I don't know about this, man. Or are you gonna stick it through? Like, no, like this is important, you know. No matter what happens, I have to do this.
And I think to further that point, as an example, I used to be a coordinator at a college day program for adults with IDD. We used to have to do active shooter drills. And this involved us making sure that all of our students had to be in one safe, disclosed area. So it was my responsibility to make sure that everyone was safe. And so we would get them to that place. And then it's also still my responsibility to kind of check the area and make sure everything's okay. And I used to always say, I don't know what I would do in this situation if it arose, but I knew I was going to keep the people I was supposed to keep safe, safe. And I think that ties perfectly into what you just said. You really don't know until you have to display that you don't have the fear. Because in that moment, I had no idea what I would do. But I just knew that I don't want anybody that I'm in the care of to get hurt. So I have another question. In exploring vulnerability and in my thinking that our society and country does not care about relationships. How do you two feel about the fact that, whether it be in elementary school, back when we were in school, or middle school, we learned sex education before we learned anything in school about family and relationships? How do you all feel about that?
When did you learn about family and relationships?
Never.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think about that, and I think, well, one question I have is it, should it be the job of the school to teach you that, or should you be taught that at home?
Definitely at home.
Right. But you could also ask that about sex education. Is it, should the school, public school, you know, tax paid, you know, government sponsored, whatever public school, whatever public school is, should that be where the kids are being taught sex education, or should the parents, the family, the parents,
I don't know,
be teaching that?
Can you trust parents to teach your kids sex education?
Well, if you can't, how could you trust teachers?
And I think it boils down to
just curriculum.
Yeah, I think it boils down to just the individual. Mm-hmm. But the other question is, are kids learning sex ed now?
Mm-hmm.
I can figure that out later because I work with a lot of parents. My mom did not want me to learn sex education at school, and she made it known because you had to get a form signed. So they provided her with the video so she could teach me herself, and she did.
Mm-hmm.
She did a pretty good job.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think it really varies, but to your point, if you can learn sex education in school, even though it probably should be a responsibility of the parent, then this goes the same way for the relationship. Mm-hmm. It should be taught at home. It should be taught both times to me. Mm-hmm. But if the teachers can teach it, then it should work both ways, in my opinion.
So here's a question, right? So sex ed is the name of the subject, but when you're in school and you're learning sex ed, what are you actually learning? So what I remember is, probably all I remember from that is teachers saying why you should use condoms, or I think that was it. Why you should use condoms, and it taught you about sexually transmitted diseases.
Lots of focus on STDs.
And really, that's all I remember. Like these are diseases, and this is a condom, which, you know, prevent, and maybe they touch a little bit on unexpected teen pregnancies or something like that. I think they talked about unexpected teen pregnancies and STDs and condoms. And to me, when I think about sex, I don't really think much about any of those things. Mm. As you know,
really, no. When I went through sex ed, mm-hmm, at school.
Yeah.
They taught some basic anatomy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anatomy, yeah.
And then they went straight into consequences, almost like they're just trying to scare it out of you.
Yeah. But then do you automatically associate, does a child automatically then associate sex with negativity?
From that curriculum, yes.
Yeah, you know. And I understand the one to maybe discourage that from children, people of a certain age, but at the same time, it's like, when is the right time to even be having that discussion? Some of the kids at the time were undoubtedly sexually active, and others, it would be maybe 10 years before they would ever become sexually active, maybe even more. And so, you know, how appropriate was that? And is that conversation to have in class in a certain grade, you know?
I don't know. I wouldn't even really know how to approach that, because I think it's important to touch base on the consequences, but I wouldn't know where or how. I feel like teaching kids about sex without the consequences might just result in kids experimenting before they would have.
I think there is,
but on the flip side,
I think there's like an explorative look into it for some kids.
Especially now.
Yeah.
It's so easy to find that information. You don't even
internet, right?
Yeah, you don't even see kids of puberty age without phones anymore.
Yeah.
They come out the womb with phones. They doctor smack them and give them an iPhone.
Yeah. you can Google anything. It gives you everything. There's no mystery to it. We We had to learn those things. We didn't really have, the internet was, when we were going through that period of our life, mm-hmm. the internet was just getting started.
Yeah.
The late 90s was when the internet was just becoming.
It was slow.
It was super slow. None of us had a phone. Mm-hmm. None of us had a phone.
Not a cell phone.
We got shipped off to college without a cell phone.
Yeah. Right.
It wasn't a thing.
And you had a desktop in the living room. So if you were going to explore, had to be careful and discreet.
And nobody was going to be able to use the house phone. And then, so like, remember the phone, the internet used to tap the house phone.
Even then, if you were to explore that growing up, you're only finding stuff that's an unrealistic representation of what it is.
Mm.
You know, if you say you tried to teach you tried to learn about sex education, and you're going through and you're finding mm-hmm. porn.
No, you go to the encyclopedia.
Oh, okay. So Eric went to the encyclopedia. The rest of us were finding porn, and it's a very unrealistic representation of how that works.
Mm.
None of it.
Yeah.
Ever happens in your household.
So, and that's part of reason, 'cause I've thought about this before. I feel like it would be nice for schools to teach relationship, because when you tackle relationship, that's a part of development of our kids growing up and learning family, and then how they navigate relationships with each other, conflict, friendships. Girlfriend, boyfriend, and sex is included.
That seems like you'd be walking a fine line to try to teach relationship in schools, especially if, you know, the fundamentals of a relationship are different depending on which state you're in.
But I mean, the school would teach we learn based off of what state we're in, so it would still apply. Yeah. Even though I wouldn't necessarily agree with everything that's being taught, that's. This is where we are right now.
Mm. Cards we've been dealt.
Here's a question though, right? So you got the family institution at home, the idea of the family institution, whatever it may be in that household, and then you have the educational institution. If the family institution at home is not very successful, does it matter? And to what extent does it matter? Maybe it's a better question. About what is done in the educational, public educational institution.
Right.
Can one competency make up for a deficiency in the home?
I don't think they could make a class long enough to cover all the bases of all the scenarios that can happen in a family.
Mm.
Right. But I think what's supposed to happen is... they have to strengthen each other. And so if we have a family dynamic that is weak, you would need somebody to come in to provide a level of support. And the parent has to know what resources they have. And so with the type of work I do, I'm a therapist, and I work with parents who have juveniles that have behavioral issues. And this could be illegal involvement, or it could just be problems in the home and at school. A lot of times when a parent does not necessarily have the skills to be a parent, we try and identify at a school or through means of other natural supports, whether it be family members, if the kid is involved in some type of pro-social activity, as we call it, which is like any type of positive activity. Mm-hmm. We try and identify other adults that can partner with the parent to act as the actual resource for development. And so I think a lot of times I find myself going to schools where they want to know that there is another support because the parent isn't necessarily navigating it. Mm-hmm. And so it's good to have therapists and other people who kind of can work together to get everybody to be a partnership.
And like one thing I think about is, you know, and like you brought up therapists and other adults, other people in the community that could help if there's like a deficiency in the home with a parent, you know, not being able maybe to teach or set the example they need to set. Thinking back, like how things were more so when we were young, but even more so than that, you know, probably with our parents, grandparents' generation, there was a lot more close-knit idea, not just idea, but close-knit extended family, mm-hmm. community, as far as neighbors, whether they were neighbors, family, friends, church family, really, you know, or whatever type of religious affiliation you had. And that was something in between what was in the household and what was public, like public school or, you know, something in the public domain, a therapist or something like that. Before you even got there, you had grandma, you had, you know, good close family friends, and, you know, maybe even people in a church or place of worship that could help in that community. You had a community that can help the family be strong and help with the upbringing of the children. You know, when the kids were away from the house, they were in another household where you knew that they were getting some things that were going to help them with life. Given that the people involved were, you know, good people with good advice.
I think a lot of today's extended families are broken.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You think about, you know, at one point in time, it would be, and it's still happens time to time here and there, different types and groups of people in different places. But people used to have more than just the two generations in a household.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have three, four, maybe five generations of people in a household.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had an extended family. They cared for each other. You had built-in babysitters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you got old, you had built-in caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about places like a good example from the documentary I watched on the Blue Zones,
mm-hmm.
like Sardinia.
Okay.
A large island part of Italy.
Mm.
They're a Blue Zone, which they regularly age to be centenarians.
Mm. Over 100.
Right. And they still have tight communities. You still have, you know, mothers, 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 all in the same household or maybe right next door to one another to take care of each other. There's no nursing homes. Mm. There's no old elderly care facilities.
Yeah.
They have family. Their extended families aren't broken. Here, you know, and this is reaching out there and digging myself in a hole, but here our extended families are broken. We all have to have our own houses, and we all have to have our own cars. Mm. And the old people get old, and we don't want them around. They've got to put them in nursing homes, and the nursing homes cost fortune, and we're all broke, and it's this vicious cycle. One generation after another, and it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, the interesting thing is sometimes the parents might have difficulty discussing a topic, connecting, being vulnerable with a child on a certain topic. It could be sex education or something like that, but grandma don't.
Mm-hmm. No.
She don't even have a filter, but she does have more wisdom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a lot of times you would get multi-generational wisdom growing up.
But not if you only saw your grandparents on special occasions.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and even if you only saw them on Christmas, Thanksgiving, you know, you still get a little bit, but
a little bit.
Yeah, because some people don't even see them then. Mm-hmm. You know, because you know holidays come and we're just gonna do our own thing at our house, or we're gonna have a friends. What do you call it?
Friendsgiving
or something. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, you do ask the question, well, where's grandma? Where's grandpa? Where's the extended family? Where auntie, uncle, where my cousins at?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, where are my cousins? What is my neighbor even doing? Do people know their neighbors anymore? You know,
right? No.
And so so much. I think now we're looking to the government often to do so much that really historically occurred within the community.
Well, we have to go to certain schools. Mm. And then we have to, you know, get certain degrees and get certain jobs that require us to go way over here. And then we lose touch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting, though, because and I do think that's what happens. But I don't think it's necessarily what has to happen, because you do see some, like I've seen some people in different cultures, and they may have relatives in another country, but they keep in touch.
I do keep
where touch. Where are you going? Where are you going this Christmas? Oh, we're going to Japan to visit my parents, to spend Christmas with them. Japan. You live in North Carolina. You going to Japan? Oh yeah, my family out there, of course.
On the other hand, you know, some people they become, I'm gonna use the word estranged. They'll become estranged from their family, not necessarily in the definition of estranged, but more just distant, we'll say. And then when they do finally have the courage to be vulnerable with those people that they don't talk to very often, sometimes they're disappointed. Sometimes they get very quickly reminded why they're estranged.
Yeah.
But sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're vulnerable and it pays off. Question is, do you have the courage to be vulnerable?
And then it's also, so sometimes in relationships, like you could have someone and you're distant from them, and then you have that experience of being back around them, and you're like, we're not clicking. It's just not happening. But sometimes there can be, you know, when there's more extended family around, you have those individuals that kind of serve as catalysts, and they kind of help bring people together. Like you have people that help bring people together. And if they weren't there being who it is that they were, sometimes the other people would never have come together. And so sometimes it takes more than to just have two people trying to come together. Sometimes you really need that community to help those bonds, help to build those bonds, and to help to keep everyone connected, you know. So some folks are like the glue.
Right. So the whole village concept. I wanted to touch on this because I think that the village concept is important as it expands outside of the family. Because as I've been navigating through schools and the type of work that I do, you start to learn that kids have different experiences, and at a young age, children can be put on the sex offenders list. And so as a confidentiality, you cannot know, and it cannot be expressed, what children are on the sex offenders list and they go to public school. And so it can be dangerous what isn't being taught and what is being taught at a school, because now these kids are around other children and they don't necessarily know how to be appropriate. And so that's why it's like a slippery slope, because you want children to be aware because they are now in a group environment with other kids.
You went and dropped a bomb. I didn't even think about that.
It's a reality. And the other thing is, these kids are now involved in families that aren't protecting them. They're taking advantage of the vulnerability. So now you have a child that can't trust the family that they have, because a lot of times the family knows what's happening. They know that a child has been sexually assaulted, and then that child is now sexually assaulting others. And so when you do have a subject like sexual education and you start teaching it, that child now has another outlet to say, hey, something wrong is happening, and they get to communicate it where they can't communicate it to their family. And so that's why these conversations are important, but it's still something that we all need to have a talk about, because you never know whose life you could save when you really do have a conversation. Because a lot of times we put our trust in our family. And a lot of times it's an uncle. It could be a dad. It could be your aunt. And the family around them doesn't want to ruin that relationship. The relationship becomes more important than the safety of their children. Mm-hmm. And you yeah. see it a lot.
You're not born wow. thinking your family's out to get you.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably not.
There's been cases of men that have assaulted generations of their family that I'm aware of. And it just keeps going. It's a pattern. And so it's one of those things where it's tough to navigate because the family themselves have become used to it. It's acceptable, so they don't stop it. It just keeps happening, and nobody protects the next generation to come. It's really sad.
So this brings up a good point, and it's like, and I don't think it's usually thought of as vulnerability, but when you're in a situation like that and you have this pressure to stay the status quo, this pressure to stay maintaining appearances or agreeing with a collective on an issue, even though you know that, hey, this is not right. I think it takes courage because you know that that's not something that you necessarily just jump in and leave. You have to have heart to say, hey, you know, I might take a lot of heat for saying no or speaking against or taking actions against what's going on here that's wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. Even though it may make me vulnerable, people may try to attack me in different ways because they would be being exposed for the wrong that's going on, but I have to make myself vulnerable in order to stand up, you know, for what's right in this situation.
It's tough because sometimes you have to make that decision against your family, or you may have to make it a decision against the people you work with, schools. You see a lot of situations where adults abuse their power, and they're able to continually abuse their power because they're in a structure that won't hold them accountable for what they're doing.
Mm. Even in my job, I work in a line of work where it can be very dangerous and very unforgiving. And there is a right way to do things, a safe way to do things. And it can be very safe if it's done that way. And you'll see people not doing it that way. And this seems like beans of importance compared to what you just said. But I feel like it should be said anyway. But people will want to correct unsafe actions that other people make. Mm-hmm. And it's encouraged that if you see somebody doing something wrong or unsafe, that you tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, I don't know if you know you're doing it this way, but that's not the safe way to do it. Because nobody wants to get hurt. And mm-hmm. nobody wants to see anybody get hurt, especially at anywhere. And but you have to have the courage to talk to them. You're opening yourself up. You're being vulnerable just to talk to these people that are doing something wrong, because they could. I mean, these people bark back. These people, especially if they've been there a long time and they're kind of, I'll call it, institutionalized into this certain. Yeah, they're set in this way that they've been doing it. Maybe that's how they did it, 30 years ago, back when the mortality rate was, so many times higher than it is now. But you got to be vulnerable to reach out to these people, even though you know that they can hurt you. They can say things about you. They can. It's like reaching out to somebody that you've never met and talking to them. It could end badly, but is it really that bad? They can't eat you.
That's still an important point because it ties into a mentality that is taught to people who could be victimized, and it is the no snitching culture, and so it's applied in so many different facets of our life where you don't speak up about this or you don't talk about that. But what is the message we're actually sending? That it is a thing where you have to worry about not talking or speaking up when somebody's life could be in danger. Because this might seem selfish, but if I'm working at a job and real harm could take place to somebody, why would I want to be exposed to what you could potentially see when somebody does get hurt, versus them just doing it the correct way? Because I have learned and seen certain things that can happen in a job when you're not being safe.
It can be bad.
Very bad. And it's one of those things where, like, just do things the right way. Don't cut corners. Like, look out for one another, because what you're not doing the correct way can affect somebody else. And a lot of our kids they're growing up in a culture where it's like, don't snitch, don't. But you don't know how they take that, and you don't know how anybody takes it to where they don't speak up about the things they need to speak up about. Mm-hmm. It's definitely, it could be a matter of life and death. And we're sitting up here preaching this, like, this isn't the streets. This is real life. It's a reality. Mm-hmm. Certain things we definitely need to talk about. Yeah. And everybody should be comfortable talking up about it.
Oh, yeah. And I think what I see is, like, several interconnected things. There's the individual attitude, individualist, and there's there's a lack of competent leadership. Mm-hmm. And when you have a lack of that competent leadership, you have a low performance culture. So you have a culture that's not prioritizing things like safety, you know, and you have a bunch of people that are follower. You know, you don't have a leadership culture. You have people maybe mistaking leadership for just being lone wolves, because a leader is someone that has to be vulnerable for all the reasons you have mentioned. But also, a leader is a team player. Right. A leader is not a lone wolf. You're a lone wolf. You're not leading anybody.
Right.
You don't have followers. So a leader, when you have a strong leader, and in the culture of leadership, everyone is a leader when they need to be. But then there's also a hierarchy. You know, you also have people with specific jobs, so they're lead over this area, lead over that area, and set up the culture so that people understand, hey, this is a team thing. This is not just about you. We have to be safe. Mm-hmm. You know, what you're doing, you may be doing something unsafe, and it affects everybody. And no one wants to see you get hurt, and also, everyone is not just thinking individually. We're thinking of the team. We want to be successful as a team. And so we're going to practice good leadership. And that means speaking up when we need to speak, you know, and demonstrating the right thing. And it takes skill. Some people may want to lead in certain areas, but don't know how to talk to people or don't know how to talk to certain people. Could come off too aggressively, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have to be effective, you got to understand how to communicate effectively with the person you're wanting to communicate with. But also it helps when senior leadership is also setting a good example. Otherwise, it could feel like fighting an uphill battle.
Right. Yeah. I think we covered a lot of good stuff.
Tip of the iceberg.
Hope you enjoyed. Come back for the next one. Hit us up on the socials. If you're watching this on YouTube, subscribe, like, hit the bell if you want to be notified whenever we release another one of these. Leave a comment, email us, let us know how we're doing.